seek a strong finish to our current fiscal year, call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org to make your gift today. And thanks.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We begin today with a story that's making headlines around the world. We're talking about the conviction of three journalists in Egypt in connection with their reporting. On Monday, Peter Gresta, Mohammed Fahmy, and Bahir Mohammed were found guilty of conspiring with the Muslim Brotherhood and spreading false news. Gresta and Fahmy were sentenced to 7 years in prison, and Mohammed is set to serve an additional 3 years for possession of ammunition. They're all with the network Al Jazeera. Their detention and now conviction have sparked outrage. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry called the conviction, quote, chilling, draconian, and a setback to Egypt's transition, unquote. As you might imagine, many news organizations around the world, including NPR, are objecting to the treatment of these journalists and are participating in a Twitter campaign around the hashtag #FreeAJStaff. Now, this is noteworthy because so much of Egypt's recent political transition has been chronicled by, and some even credit it to, the work of journalists and bloggers in Egypt and the region. We wanted to hear more about the rulings and life as a journalist in Egypt right now, so we've called upon Mona El-Tahawi. She's a freelance journalist who's been active in the press and on social media during and after the Arab Spring. She's with us by phone from Cairo. Mona, nice to have you back with us. Also joining us is Basil El-Dab. He's the politics editor for Daily News Egypt. That's an independent English language newspaper. He's also with us from Cairo. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Mona, may I start with you? Your reaction to the ruling?
I'm outraged. I think it's an utter disgrace and a really shameful day. I think that the charges that they were put on trial for were absolutely ridiculous. And by all accounts, from all the people who attended the trial, none of those charges have been proven. So I think it's an awful day. But I think it's also really important to put this very, very chilling trial in the perspective of the terrible crackdown that's been happening in Egypt over the past year against civil liberties in general, and to remember that there are at least 16,000 prisoners of conscience in Egyptian jails, many of whom we know nothing about. So I think that we have a lot to be outraged about in Egypt today.
Basil, we'd amplify that if you would. And I do want to mention that there were those who had hoped that the new president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, might have pardon these journalists. He has said he will not interfere. There were some who would hope that he would have overturned the verdicts or pardoned them as some sort of a gesture of conciliation. He has said he will not. So, Baza, I wanted to ask more about what you feel this is really about. What is the intention here?
Well, there are a few things going on. First of all, there has been a lot of sort of unprecedented crackdown on the freedom of the press in Egypt in terms of independent media, foreign and domestic. Al Jazeera has been a news organization that has been specifically called out by various members of the government at various times for, allegedly presenting a brotherhood agenda. And this goes into sort of the strained relationships between Egypt and Qatar. So really, when we're looking at this trial, yes, it very much has to do with freedom of the press, and it'll always be tied to that. But there's also sort of this aspect to go along with it, where really, there are political scores that, are being settled between Egypt and Qatar, and really these journalists just sort of found themselves in the middle of it.
Mona, what about you? I think for those who follow your work and those who've heard you on this program and others, you may remember that you were brutally attacked in 2011 as you covered the Tahrir Square protests. You were, both of your arms were broken. You were assaulted, viciously. You were detained by military intelligence for about 10 hours. I confess that at the time, I believed that it was because you were a woman. And as a visible woman journalist, what do you think is the real agenda here?
I think the fact that Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, as you mentioned, is our new president is one of the main things that we have to focus on here. He's the former head of military intelligence. You mentioned that I was detained by military intelligence. And we have to put this in the bigger picture of Egypt basically struggling against 6 decades of military rule. So the fact that the head of military intelligence is now running the country, and he's running the country, I mean, that what happened to me is by no means unusual. In fact, I consider myself very lucky in the fact that I'm a dual citizen, so the State Department intervened. Al Jazeera and The Guardian at the time gave wide coverage to the fact that I had disappeared and was being detained. And because I had a profile, I think it protected me in a way that had I been, as I told you at the time, an ordinary Egyptian woman who had none of those so-called protectors, I very well might have been killed. So despite what happened to me, I feel very lucky. But if you look at the case yesterday, none of those so-called protectors have helped the journalists because of the political climate between Egypt and Qatar that Basil mentioned, and because I believe that Abdel Fattah el-Sisi understands now, and this is very sinister, he understands that he can really push the boundaries and Egypt's international allies will do absolutely nothing. Because you have to remember that the verdict was passed while John Kerry was still in Egypt. And just the day before the verdict, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, told Egypt that the U.S. would release millions of dollars that had been suspended in aid to Egypt. Just a few months ago, Apache helicopters, which had also been put on hold, were promised back to Egypt. And the Canadian government, now Mohamed Fahmy, one of the journalists who's been convicted, is a dual citizen, also a Canadian-Egyptian. The Canadian government has said, quote unquote, it's disappointed. Now, I think it deserves a bit more than disappointment. So if you're in Sisi's shoes, you're former military intelligence, you know the military runs the country, and your allies are just disappointed and still give you aid, you know that you can keep pushing this.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about life in Egypt as journalists. We're talking about this in the wake of the sentencing of three journalists to long prison sentences on charges of spreading false news. We're speaking with freelance writer Mona El-Tahawi and political reporter Basil El-Dab. Both are with us from Egypt, from Cairo. So, Basil, what now? How do you proceed?
You know, over the last year or so, things have become increasingly difficult, you know, what to report on. You know, when you look at this case, they're being accused of, you know, supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and they just gave interviews to some members. We could be implicated by simply based on, you know, talking to, you know, a certain side of the conflict, which is obviously a very fundamental part of what we have to do. At the same time, you know, there's pressure out on the street when we're doing field work. We get hassled a lot by security. In terms of our foreign reporters, we have some of those at Daily News Egypt. You know, there's growing xenophobia out on the street and lack of trust in the foreign press, in the press in general, but the foreign press specifically. So we're kind of seeing this increasingly hostile environment where it's becoming very difficult to do our jobs on a daily basis.
Well, can I ask about that? And well, Mona, and as a freelancer, I'm wondering how it is for you. I mean, you're both Egyptian nationals, and you both have family in the country as well, and you both write in English. I mean, how do you navigate that?
Well, you know, personally speaking, there are many things to balance here. Just about 10 days or 2 weeks before our presidential elections that Abdel Fattah el-Sisi won in a landslide, a pro-CCTV anchor used a segment on her show to claim that I was basically a U.S. and an Israeli spy and that I was being anti-military. And she brought on a mother to speak to her on the phone during her show who claimed that I had gone to a high school the week before to speak to students about my work. And I had answered a question about the presidential elections. And I'd said that, you know, I believe that we should end military rule. And I brought up the fact that Sisi was head of military intelligence that had during the revolution or shortly after Mubarak stepped down, subjected Egyptian female activists to so-called virginity tests, which are considered rightfully so sexual assault. So this mother was on television basically saying that I had gone to the high school to brainwash her kids. So to have this said on Egyptian television and to be so clearly labeled as being anti-military during a time that this crackdown is happening is extremely worrying. And I have, you know, my mother saying, get out of the country, get out of the country. And I don't want to. I want to stay. So it is very worrying on a personal level. Now, when it comes to being a woman in Egypt, there's another level of worry because when I was attacked in 2011, I was sexually assaulted as well as had my arms broken. The levels of sexual violence in Egypt and the complete lack of safety for women on the street touches on everybody, not just me. But this is a real concern, and we've had a rise in mob sexual assaults that are not specific to any political group. Any Egyptian woman can face these sexual assaults. So you're talking about a political worry that covers that basically affects all Egyptians. Mm-hmm. But as a woman, the fear of being sexually assaulted again is definitely a concern for me on a daily basis.
What can I just ask, Mona, before we let you go here, is there any leverage in this situation? Is there any leverage on the other side? Are there any voices speaking up in favor of a free and thorough media presence? Mona, is there anybody pushing against that?
Absolutely. I mean, there are incredibly courageous activists who are opposing the regime in various ways every day. That's why I was saying earlier that it's important to put this in that larger perspective of the crackdown. A couple of days before the Al Jazeera trial verdicts, we saw at least 20 activists, peaceful protesters, taken in because they were protesting the very draconian protest law that we have in Egypt. So despite all of these fears, despite this terrible crackdown, there are still people who are willing to go out there and risk their lives in protesting. There are others who perhaps don't want to be on the street and use other forms of activism. But I think it's the thing that keeps me in Egypt and the thing that keeps me optimistic is that unlike many years of the Mubarak regime, there is a significant enough, albeit a minority, but it's not about minorities or majorities. It's the importance of the existence of a group of Egyptians, and they do exist, who understand that a huge injustice is happening and continue to fight that injustice. As long as that group remains, that's really important, and it's important to remember that. But for people to look at Egypt just 3 years after Mubarak stepped down and to say you have failed, I think that in itself is an injustice.
Basil, final thought from you?
Yeah, I mean, moving forward, as Mona said, there are a lot of, you know, there's a core of young activists that has really kind of, they stood in front of the military council in 2011 and did the same under Morsi when you know, his regime was overseeing violations. And they're standing up now. And I think on top of that, Egypt is lucky enough to have sort of, some civil society and human rights organizations that are very principled, who have documented things very carefully. You know, it's a very polarized society. So to be able to stand back and have people sort of say it how it is, document things objectively, provide sources, things like that, I think this is a very important sort of cornerstone moving forward. And Egypt, at the very least, is lucky enough to have that.
Basil El-Dab is the politics editor for Daily News Egypt. Mona El-Tahawi is a freelance journalist who writes about Arab politics and feminism. We reached them both in Cairo. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Coming up, you're packing up the dorm or your crash pad at mom and dad's, and you are ready to move into your own place. Yay! But have you read that lease? Do you know what it'll really cost? In our Money Coach conversation, we'll tell you how not to make the common mistakes faced by first-time renters. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Sell your soul, it opens a deep, dark hole. When you sell your soul, it opens a deep, dark hole.
That's Mary Gaucher from her new album, Trouble and Love. On the next Fresh Air, she performs autobiographical songs in our studio. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for some money coaching. This is the part of the program where we talk about the economy and personal finance. Today we're going to spend some time on things you need to know if you are in transition. In a few minutes, we'll talk about buffing up those job interview skills with the author of that classic career guide, What Color Is Your Parachute? But first, let's say you got that good first job. You're getting a place of your own. Exciting! But there are some common pitfalls we'd like to help you avoid. Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine recently wrote about this, the seven sins of first-time renters. We called Pat Eswine to tell us more. She's an associate editor there, and she's with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
So let's just go about. Let's just go down the list, as many as we can, of those seven, you didn't say deadly sins, but they kind of are financially, they could be financially deadly. The first thing she says is, don't underestimate the cost. How much should you pay for rent?
You know, it's not so much how much you pay for rent. It's figuring out what the total rental cost is going to be for you. So you need to do some research, maybe starting a couple months in advance of finding a place. So you might have to pay an application fee. You might have to put a deposit, a security deposit of the equivalent to a month's rent. You may have to ante up the first month's rent. In some places, you may have to ante up the last month's rent, as well as a pet deposit, parking fee, possibly deposits for utility service like for gas and electric. So, you know, you could need $4,000 right up front.
So get the big picture, get the total picture.
Right.
The other thing that you say is another sin is not getting your priorities straight. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, who wouldn't want a place with great amenities like a party room, a gym, a pool, you know, on-site parking, et cetera, et cetera. But in order to get that for a cost you can afford, you might have to be pretty far out of the city. If your job is downtown, do you really want to have to put up with a grueling commute every day? Mm-hmm. So you have to know what's important to you.
And really focus on what's important. Is it the commute or is it the party room or the pool or something
right.
of that sort? You know, you also talk about the importance of reading the lease. Now, this might seem like a no-brainer, but I can see a scenario where if your parents had never rented or it was a long time ago and you know, they own their home and that's all you know, you might not think about that. Why is that so important?
Well, a lease is a legally binding contract between you and the landlord. It's going to set out the rules that you have to live by and what your rights are and what the landlord's rights are. So it's really crucial to read it very carefully, understand what those rules and rights are, and if you don't understand something, ask so that you can have that explained to you.
Is there something that tends to trip people up? Like, are there escalation clauses or something that might be in there that you might not know anything about? What should you be looking for?
Well, I think one thing that is often an issue for people just starting out is that they might want to bring in a roommate to share the rent and cost of utilities. But the lease may prohibit you from doing that, or it may require that the landlord approve the new roommate. So that's known as subletting, and that's often covered in the lease. And if that's something you hope to do, you better know what the rules are.
Still talking about money, you say renter's insurance is something that a lot of renters don't think about. Tell me why that's important.
Sure. The landlord is going to insure the building. So he's covered if the place burns down or if there's a fire. But if you're renting in that building and you don't have renter's insurance and you have water damage or there's a fire in your unit, if you don't have renter's insurance, the cost to replace your stuff isn't going to be covered. So unless you have very deep pockets and you don't care, you need renter's insurance. And that'll typically cost you from about $12 to $21 a month. Something you should do if you have a car and have auto insurance, call up your auto insurance company to find out if you can get a discount on renter's insurance.
Again, and two things, I'm going to put these two together. You say not seeing the apartment before moving in, you know, put the place through its paces, you know, turn on the faucets and things of that sort. And also not asking about utilities or forgetting to turn them on.
Right. The landlord may expect you to call up the gas company or the electric company to have that service turned on. So you want to do that. If that's the case, you want to do that about a week before you move in. Otherwise, you could be taking sponge baths at the sink for a week.
If you're lucky and those faucets in fact work. And then finally you say, you know, forgetting basic items to make a home. Again, this might seem like a no-brainer, but you could easily see where somebody who's just starting out might forget. You need a bed.
Sure.
Or something to sleep on.
You need something to sleep on. It might just be a mattress on the floor. You need a shower curtain in all likelihood, and you probably need a can opener. You can find lists of things you need to outfit an apartment at about.com.
And yeah, there are lots of resources, Craigslist and people like that, neighborhood, you know, yard sales. A lot of neighborhoods have like whole neighborhood-wide estate sales. But don't forget, you need something to sleep on, something to eat on,
right.
Hopefully something to sit on.
Right.
Finally, you know, we were talking about this earlier. We only have about 50 seconds left. You mentioned a lot of people, this is not on your list, but bringing in a roommate can sometimes be a great thing. It could be a disaster. Is there anything
sure.
you should really think about before you do that?
Well, you want to make sure that you interview a prospective roommate and be sure to interview more than one so that you can find a person that's the best fit in terms of personality and living habits. If you've been living in a dorm, you may have already had the experience of having to put up with someone you really don't like for a period of time. And you also want to make sure that they can actually pay their share of the rent.
That's key. Pat Eswine is associate editor with Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. We're talking about a piece published in the magazine called The Seven Sins of First-Time Renters. Pat, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We're going to turn now from navigating rent to navigating your career. Spring college graduates are swarming the job market, as well as, well, people with more experience who find themselves in transition, including some broadcasters you might know. You might have heard that our show winds down in August. So we thought this was as good a time as any for a refresher on interviewing, things like what to wear and how to answer those annoying but typical questions like, what's your greatest weakness? Joining us now to provide answers to this and other questions are Richard Bowles. He's author of the classic career navigation guide, What Color Is Your Parachute? A practical manual for job hunters and career changers. He's with us now from San Francisco, California. Mr. Bowles, thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C., Christine Cruz-Vergara. She's Director of University Career Services at George Mason University. Welcome to you as well. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start before the interview actually happens. And Christine, I'm going to take this question to you first because these days so many people have to apply online.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they can't even get to the interview stage because, you know, they get screened out by whatever online metrics are being used. For example, mm-hmm. a science teacher applies at a school district, but all he or she receives in return are job postings for orchestra or gym teacher. Do you have any I understand that every situation is different, but do you have any kind of general guidelines for getting through those online screens?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually an old-fashioned answer, which is you have to network. You need to know your industry. You need to know the people that are in your industry, and you want to make those customized connections. That's one of the easiest ways to be able to make it past an ATS system or an applicant tracking system. And you want to learn the tricks of the trade within mm-hmm. your industry to know how to navigate that application process as seamlessly as possible.
Richard Bowles, what is the most common interview mistake that you've seen people make over the years?
How long do you have? The most common one is assuming the employer has all the power. And that you are to approach that employer as essentially a job beggar instead of seeing yourself as a real resource that can be very useful and helpful to them. So people give away their power in the sense they approach the interview as though it were a test and they have to run through a ring of questions and ace every single answer that they're giving to those questions. When in reality, it's, an interview should be viewed as a conversation. It's two people. The activity is most analogous in other human behavior to dating. It's, do we like each other? Do we want to try going steady? That's the atmosphere that ought to pervade the interview.
Hmm. Christine, I'm interested in your perspective on this because you're dealing with people who may or may not have previous work experience.
That's
and
right.
So it might be very hard for them to visualize themselves
as a resource.
As a resource. Talk to me about what would be your answer to the question. What's
sure.
the common interview mistake that you see people make?
Yeah, I actually think this is even beyond just the interview, but a common mistake is people not recognizing that they are their own brand. And so sometimes they look at themselves and they think, I have a professional brand or I have a personal brand, and not really recognizing that as an individual, you have one brand. And how you present yourself from the moment you apply with your resume and your cover letter all the way through the interview needs to be a consistent brand. And you, what you're putting out there on social media, on the web, things like that, that's your digital footprint. But what others are putting out there about you, that's your digital shadow. And you really need to make sure that that's all consistent with how you want to be perceived by your future employers.
Hmm. Richard Bowles, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, I think that there are certain mores that have changed over the years. Like I remember blue suit or the black suit? That was pretty much the choice, right? No matter, like, blue suit or black suit, right? And no, apparently not anymore. But what do you think about that? Like, how you should kind of present yourself and prepare for an interview?
The rule is generally, if you can and you do know the place at all, that you dress as the other employees do. But if you fail in any guidance in that direction, you don't really know how they dress there. The answer is always overdress rather than underdress. Mm-hmm. Because every employer that has any brains knows full well you are coming on your best behavior and therefore in your best presentation of yourself when you come for an interview. So they make allowances for the fact that you may wear a suit when nobody there has even heard of a suit or whatever. But if you underdress, then they consider that to be sometimes disrespectful or sometimes showing you have no clue about how people get hired.
If you're just joining us, we are having Interview 101. Our guests are Richard Bowles. He's author of the ever popular, the classic career navigation book, What Color Is Your Parachute? Also with us, Christine Cruz Vergara. She's director of university career services at George Mason University. Richard Bowles, is there anything you've changed your mind about over the years about how people should approach an interview? Something that you used to advise people to do years ago but you no longer do, or anything that you want to switch up for people who may have the early copy of the book like me? And
you're referring to the 1970 or the 1972 edition?
Oh, I'm not telling. You'll have to Google me. But
no, there's a distinction to be made. I mean, I'm 87 years old now, so I've got more wisdom than I had when I first wrote the book, and I do revise it every year. But there's a distinction to be made that's very important, and that is between the form and the content. The content of the interview has not changed one whit over the years. It's still two people circling each other, trying to figure out if they like each other enough to actually spend time together in a productive relationship. What has changed is the form. We used to tell people, go to your Sunday Metropolitan newspaper and look for ads. Well, now we say go on Monster or Career Builder or Dice or one of the others and look for the postings of whatever vacancies there may be there. But I've not seen much change in the absolute substance of the interview as such. I think that has remained the same because human nature has not changed.
Mm. Is there a question that a lot of interviewees or the people that you counsel just can't stand? Like, they hate that question and they want some advice about how best to answer that question. So, Richard, do you want to start us off? What's the question that everybody hates? Tell them how to answer it.
They hate the question, tell me about yourself, because they don't know how to answer that. Do you want to know where I went to school, or what is it you want to know? The answer to that question, incidentally, the correct answer is they want to know what it is about you that fits you to do this job. In other words, they want a very particular narrowing. And many employers have told me they use this test as a way of deciding who they're going to interview further or who they're going to let the interview kind of wind down by the way in which the person answers the question. It's deliberately left open by employers, vague. They want to see, how do you think on your feet? How do you answer a question you didn't see coming? But you talk to one job hunter after another, they're very scared about that question, and they have a right to be, because it's not clear there's a definite answer you should give, except that it should be only that about you which is relevant to the job you're applying for.
And then the biggest weakness question, so Christine, I'll ask you this question.
Yeah.
This is one that drives people crazy. When somebody asks you, like, what's your biggest weakness, what should you say?
Yeah.
I'm too modest? What?
Well, I think the biggest mistake you can make is trying to turn one of your strengths into a weakness. HR professionals see right through that, and it ends up coming across as extremely lame and just not real, honestly. So I think what you should do is...
I care too much about my work.
That's right. It's just not going to fly. That's not going to fly.
Can I throw in a quick thought on,
sure.
on
sure.
the tail of Christine's answer? All jobs devolve into skills with people, or skills with data or information, or skills with things. If you analyze the job that you're competing for or applying for, and you decide it primarily is jobs require skills with people and with information, Then when they say, what's your weakness? Mention a skill in the area they don't care about, which would be your skills with things. There you can honestly say, I'm not that good with such and such and such and such. But because you know they're primarily looking for skills in the other two families, you will not put yourself out of the running for that job.
I would agree with Richard, and I'd also add on to that. Talk about how you're working on it. A lot of employers want to see some level of initiative and being proactive. So if you know that you're not particularly great at being organized, for example, talk about what strategies are you putting in place to help you navigate that.
All right, Christine, final thought. Thank you note, yes or no? And if so, when?
Yes, absolutely. And I say within 24 hours.
Within 24 hours?
24 to 48 hours. Yeah. Personalized thank you note as soon as possible.
But not like pink perfumed stationery, presumably.
No.
Okay. Christine Cruz Vergara is Director of University Career Services at George Mason University. She was nice enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Richard Bowles is author of the Career Navigation Bible, What Color is Your Parachute? A Practical Manual for Job Hunters and Career Changers. The 43rd edition comes out this August. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR member station KQED, which is in San Francisco, California. Thank you note to follow prompt. Thank you both so much for speaking to us.
Thank you, Michelle.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, school's out and you have decided you do not want to spend the next 8 weeks prying your kids off the couch or breaking up fights over the Xbox, and you thought summer camp's a great idea. But what if your child doesn't want to go, cries when you mention it, and has to be peeled out of the car? Our parenting panel is here to help with some advice on picking the right camp and getting your kids on board. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from PBS, with American Experiences Freedom Summer, the 1964 campaign to end racial inequality in Mississippi, tonight at 9 on PBS. From Carnegie Corporation, supporting the New Americans campaign and all their partners promoting citizenship. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young. We'll join filmmaker John Waters in a live audience to talk about his trip hitchhiking across America.
People thought I was a homeless man. People tried to give me money all the time, which was incredibly moving to me. But technically, I could have called a helicopter to come get me.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. This week, I'll be joined by guest panelists Randy Thornton, Marianne Metz, and David Robson. We'll offer advice for the summer gardening season, and we'll be answering your calls and emails live on the air. Join us for Mid-American Gardener Thursday night at 7 on WILL-TV, or listen Saturday morning at 6:30 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, we're going to camp. For some families, this is a rite of passage going back generations. For many kids, it's a welcome break from siblings and school and a chance to try something new or be somebody new. And if you're a parent, you know there are hundreds of options out there, from sleepover camps with cabins and hiking and canoeing, to camps catering to every religious denomination and atheists. And there's also math camp, skateboard camp, and camps where you can learn to write code. But what if your child has a meltdown every time you mention it? What if you loved your camp, but they cry at drop-off? We wanted to get some advice on finding the right summer camp at the right price and getting your children ready to go. So our parenting panel is with us now. Robert Nicholas, host of the web show My Life as a Dad. He's a father of seven. Welcome back, Robert.
Thank you.
Jenny Morgenthau is executive director of the Fresh Air Fund. That organization has been providing summer experiences, including camp, to millions of children from low-income families in New York City since 1877. Welcome. Not that you were there, Jenny, that whole time. I just want to clarify that. But thank you for your work. Thanks for coming.
And thank you so much for having me.
And Kenya Young is also with us. She's a mom of two boys and a producer at NPR. So welcome to you all. I'm glad you're here because I never went to camp. So this was all kind of new to me. So, Robert, you have seven kids, and I understand that all of them went to camp. Why do you think that that's important?
Well, the 1.5-year-old has not gone to camp yet, but she will somewhere down the line. I think camp is really good because it allows the child some independent learning. The more independent learning they can have as they're growing up and maturing, the better off they're going to be in life when they take off to go to college or they take off to do other things that are going to be important to them. So the independent learning and the chance to be themselves a little bit is really the most important reason for camp.
Jenny, what about you? You know, obviously, I think for people in the New York area, they've heard about the Fresh Air Fund. This is, as I mentioned, a New York institution, and obviously lots of people support it, and they think it's important. Why do you think it's so important to give particularly city kids an opportunity to get out?
Well, I mean, I think that camp is good for all children. I was a camper for 4 years, and it's one of the best times of my life. But I think, you know, it gives city kids an opportunity to see something different and to learn something totally new. And to, I second the thing about independent learning. I mean, they learn, new skills like swimming or arts and crafts or just things that they've never, going on a hike, things that they've never done. And, it's a feeling of accomplishment and pride.
Kenya Young, you went to Camp Grandma. You grew up going to Camp Grandma, and your kids now do the same. And you were actually telling us, if you don't mind, that you think, maybe camp could be important for the parents. Tell me why you think that.
It's true. We send our kids. When I was a kid, we lived in California. I used to go to the Bronx for summers, and then we're kind of doing the exact opposite. I'm sending them from D.C. back to California. We've been doing this for a few years now, started at around 3 weeks, staying with grandma, and then 4, and then 5. We're up to 6 weeks now, which is half the summer at this point. And for us, it's really important because it's, one, you feel like it saves money. Not quite, honestly. You've got to think about the plane tickets. One of us has to drop us off. But it really is about the time with each other. My husband's a teacher, and I also work very off shifts here at NPR, so sometimes overnight, sometimes swing shift. And it really gives us a time to be with each other and have our little time together. It's somewhat of a marriage camp for us to have the kids be away. So they obviously restore that relationship with grandma as well, that we're not as close in California anymore. So there are really two elements for that. It's really their relationship with grandma and our marriage as well.
Is it okay for you to say that? I mean, how does it feel kind of admitting that? Because I'm guessing that there are a lot of parents for whom that is true, but it's kind of hard to say, I need some time away from them.
Well, and I'm very open about that, mm-hmm. that sometimes you just need to be away from your kids for some sanity. But also, our situation, not so much unique. I think quite a bit of couples go through this, but, we got engaged very quickly. We got engaged within a month of knowing each other. We got married within 8 months of being engaged. And then we were pregnant 6 months later. Our whole 12 year, we're about to celebrate 12 years. Our 12 years have been practically with kids. And that time that we have in the summer while the kids are gone really is that time that a lot of marriages had 5, 6, 7 years without kids before. It's really a restoration period for our marriage.
So talk about the fact, Robert, that lots of kids love camp. but lots of kids don't. And one of the things we were talking about in the office is how some, when I was kind of doing an informal survey of my colleagues, and it was like, it was a total U-curve. It was, some of the kids loved it. They said, oh, it was great. I wanted to go in and be a counselor. And other people said, I was in therapy for years trying to get over it, you know? That, so I just wanted to ask, and I'm not going to say who was who. So Robert, you have some tips for sending kids off to camp in a way that makes it a good experience. I mean, is there anything you can do to ensure that it's a good experience?
Well, I think number one, you want to talk to your kids. You got to talk and you got to listen. And you got to start talking well in advance. Like if I'm talking summer camp and it's the first time for my child, I'll start talking to them in January. And we'll talk about it in January, February, March, April. And also prior to that, like I think a good age for kids going off to camp is 10, 11, 12 years old if they're going to go away for the week and the overnight type camps. But if you start them earlier than that, you start them with day camps, you start them with drop-off camps, you start them with a beach camp, at a park camp, at a horseback riding, things like that. They start getting comfortable and used to that idea. Hmm. And then you want to talk to them, you want to listen. And then they will get interested and you'll be able to do some research and find things that they want to do. They're going to sit there and go, I don't want to do that. But you know what? There's a camp for kids that I don't want to do that. You can find what they need to get to. And the more you talk to them, the more you listen, start small, and you'll have a lot of success and they'll love it.
You also have a saying, separation is hard, stay cool. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's actually to the parents. And the parents have to control their own anxiety. A lot of times, it's just like dropping your kids off for preschool the very first day. My wife, I have to practically drag her around the corner with her nails scratching against the wall because she's the one that's more upset than our child, which is just, you know, prancing right in the room and saying bye-bye.
Were you spying on me? I'm sorry. I'm just like, that was you around the corner.
Yeah. So that's the message is the parents. The parents need to be confident. They need to be like, this is great. You're going to love it. This is why. And then also when they're taking them there and dropping them off and going through the progress, don't show your own anxiety. Keep, you know, allow the child to be themselves. Mm-hmm. And parents, stay cool.
Jenny, what about you? I don't know whether a lot of the campers who come to Fresh Air Fund experiences, are they the ones who want to go? Or is it that their parents think that it would be good or their caregivers think that this would be a good experience for them? Do you see a lot of homesickness and how do you deal with it?
Well, you know, I think there's not a lot of communication. I mean, you know, sometimes parents come and just dump their kid and go to work. So I don't, you know, they don't have the luxury of, you know, preparation and discussion. And you know, kids, maybe because they don't know where they're going, you know, they're less apprehensive. I don't know. I can't imagine it myself. But kids who come and do get homesick, one of the most important things is to keep them busy. I mean, we don't have free time after dinner where they sit around and cry. I mean, we, you know, really keep them busy. And sometimes we try to hook them up with an older camper who can, you know, talk about how, you know, when they first came, they were homesick and they got over it. And so, you know, we just try to sensitize everybody to the issues and help them, you know, make friends and whatever it is they don't like to do.
How do you deal with a kid who just, I just don't like it here. I don't want to be here. And I could see if this was a situation where the if something was, the parents have the luxury of being able to bring the child home. I mean, obviously, many people have, you know, different opinions about that. But, you know, money is a factor. I mean, if you have to work and if you've spent a lot of money on a camp experience and the child just doesn't like it, or if you just have to work and you need something safe and appropriate, you need a safe place for your child to be, but the child just doesn't like it, what do you do? Do you have a philosophy about that? How do you handle that?
Well, you know, it certainly depends on what level of acting out they're showing. I mean, if they're really difficult and really can't stand it, we would send them home. But, you know, sometimes we call the parents and they say, oh, he's always like that.
He's always like that. Okay. Kenya, do you mind mentioning that one of your sons has ADHD? Does that make it harder to find? Or how do you go about finding the right situation?
It has been in the past. We do, we've done camps. We usually just do day camp. We're not at the, my boys are 10 and 8. We're not at the point yet where we can think about sleepaway camp. But I've had to, you know, in the schools, we have what's called an IEHP, the individual educational program. And so the teachers really work with you. They know your kid's situation. It's a little different when you get to camp because they don't have all of that information. And so you have to think about that as you're thinking about the camps. And oftentimes, mild special needs are often just looked as bad behaved kids. They're just bad, you hear all the time. And
there are camps for kids with special needs,
specifically
for kids with ADHD.
There are camps. They're very expensive. There's one here in the district that I look at and I love, and I just drool over it every time I read about it. And I would love, love, love to send my kids there. It's very expensive, especially for the both of them to go, and it's just not something that's available to us.
So is there anything that you can do to kind of make the experience better? Are there places that even if they don't specialize in kids working with kids with ADHD, that you can do to make the situation more comfortable?
There are. When they were younger and I thought it was an issue, even though, you know, you don't pass your IEP on to the camp counselors, I did explain to them the situation. I've had some who worked with me, some who quite didn't. So there was a little extra kind of prep work that you had to do to get them situated. Now, and I think this goes to what's been said already, it's kind of the same thing with camps. I let my kids choose their camps. So we do more of the specialty camps. If they want, that we read through the booklet, they might choose the robotics. One might choose the, so they don't necessarily go to the same camps, even though they're so close in age. So one's chosen this summer a music camp, one's chosen a horseback riding camp. And that interest, I think when you have that interest, and now that they're a little older, they'll be able to, at least they've picked what they want to do, and their interest will be sustained throughout that day a little more.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about summer camp. Our parenting panel is sharing advice for picking the right one, getting them excited about it, and having a good experience. With us are Kenya Young, mom of two. She's an NPR producer. That's who was speaking just now. Jenny Morgenthau is also with us. She's executive director of the Fresh Air Fund. That's a fund that's been giving kids, New York City kids, experiences, summer experiences since 1877. And Robert Nichols also with us. He's a father of seven and the host and the founder of the web show My Life as a Dad. Robert, you were telling us that choices, you're a big believer in giving your kids a choice. Like, you get on the computer with them and research camps and stuff like that. Tell us why that's important.
Well, I think the child needs to get bought into something that they really enjoy. I had one daughter that really loved piano, and so a music camp. And also, like, a lot of kids are going to go to camp and they're going to say, well, I want to go with my friends. I want to do this. But on the other side of the coin, maybe they can have a chance to meet new friends that all love piano, and they can get that together. So my kids were really going after that as far as specialties. They piano camp to surf camp. Both my daughters also went to Costa Rica for like a turtle rescue research type camp. But I let them really think about it and pick something that they thought that they would really enjoy. And it takes effort. It's like putting your kid in timeout. The parent has to suffer when the child has to think. And you need to just be there and sit with them and go over it and go over it. And eventually they're like, they're so excited. They count the days down to go.
Have you ever had a child just say, I just don't want to go? And how have you dealt with that?
I've had them about halfway through. In fact, I think every camp that my older kids have been through, halfway through, they're on the phone with me saying that it's boring. They don't like it. It's uncomfortable. The beds are bad. The food's bad. You know, people are mean to them. All of those things. But by Saturday when they're coming home, it's, oh, I love the camp. I wish I could stay longer. Why can't it be 2 weeks? Can I go again next year? And so again, it's one of those things where you got to realize that like halfway through, they start getting that homesick. They start feeling like it's not right for them. Or maybe somebody said something that they were uncomfortable with. And then they rebond. And by the end, you got to stick with it. They feel great about themselves.
Jenny, you've had so many different experiences. I mean, you were a camper yourself. You obviously loved it, and you're working in that space. Now, any advice for parents who are just now thinking about this and haven't done this before, didn't go to camp themselves, aren't used to the idea of picking, and don't have, you know, millions of dollars to spend on, you know, sending people to, you know, space camp at Goddard or whatever they do? It's not that I know that space camp costs a lot of money, because I really don't. I'm just making that up. But go ahead.
I think a lot of the parents who send us kids have neighbors or relatives who've sent their kids to camp, and we have a pretty good reputation. So I think, you know, it's important for the parents to say how much fun they're going to have, and then they're going to get to go swimming and fishing seem to be the big activities. And, you know, that their upstairs neighbor went or their cousin Hector went, really to sort of emphasize the fun aspects of it.
Hmm. And any advice for if you're listening to this conversation and you're a kid and you're kind of scared about going away to camp, Jenny, do you have some advice that you can offer if this is new to you? This is just a first time experience for you. Do you have any words of wisdom for somebody who might be listening is kind of still a little scared?
It's just going to be a great time. You're okay. Going to have a great time.
Robert, what about you? Any words of advice?
My last words of advice, if you're going to send a care package, send homemade cookies. It's great bragging rights, and you can trade them, and kids just love the homemade cookies.
Homemade cookies. Any special kind? Do you have a recipe you're going to share?
Well, chocolate chip. Chocolate chip is the best. That and a little post-it note that says, love, Dad.
Oh, are you the chocolate chip guy? I know you're the pancake guy, but you're the chocolate chip guy, too?
Pancakes and chocolate chip cookies. What else can Dad do, right?
Kenya, what about you? Do you have some advice about, particularly for parents who have kids who might need something a little different, a little bit special? Things you might be thinking about.
Yeah, I think, quite honestly, I mean, it's just like us, right? We have sometimes you have a bad day at work and you just don't want to be there that day, but we still come back the next day. Same thing with kids in camp, quite honestly. Sometimes you might not have the greatest day while you're there, but you come back the next day and it's a fantastic day. Or like we said, at the end of the week, it's a great time. So it's kind of just what happens. It's another part, another facet, a kind of counterpart to school or what happened, and say, you know, I know today wasn't that great, but tomorrow's going to be a great one. We can give it another try and let's just kind of keep pushing on.
Can I, I'm going to put you on the spot, Kenya. What are you doing on your camp honeymoon that you can talk about?
You know, it's actually funny. We always have these grand ideas. We're going to go here and to the Poconos and to Philly and this new restaurant in D.C. Can I tell you what we do? We sit at home for the 3 weeks with each other because it's such a different home life and different experience than the kids being there all the time. And we eat at 10 o'clock at night, and we eat asparagus or cake in the morning, whatever we want to. We just live it up in ways we can't with the kids are around.
I'm not going to blow your secret. You get cake for breakfast. I'm not
going to. That's
right. Kenya Young is a mom of two boys. She's a producer at NPR. She's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Jenny Morgenthau is executive director of the Fresh Air Fund. She joined us from our bureau in New York City. Robert Nicholas, host of the web show My Life as a Dad. He's a father of seven. He was with us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.